what is Blavatsky's? There's a Secret Doctrine, and then there's another book. Is it ISIS or something?
ISIS is another book, yeah.
ISIS Unveiled or something?
ISIS Unveiled, yeah.
Yeah, Gary used to tell me, you got to read that, and it sounded like he studied that at some point in his life.
Well, during I was going to say during that period, but it's a very extended period. There are a tiny handful of books that are authentic and valuable and worth reading, and there are literally hundreds of books that are just hack jobs, and they're stolen from serious works, but in bits and pieces and so on and so forth. Books by people like Jeff Stern and people like that, they're just tripe. There are, of course, I have liquidated some of my library. I'm down to, my wife says about 7,000 books.
Hmm.
And the one thing that I have not liquidated any of is my Esoterica, which is, I guess, about 100 or 125 books, something like that. Wallace Budge and people of great scholastic reputations, there's just so much absolute trash put out that it's very hard to know, for the uninitiated, to know what's worth reading and what isn't.
Yeah, and you would recommend ISIS Unveiled?
Oh, yes. That because that's a fundamental book. It's, even if you don't buy too much of the material, it is fundamental historically. It's one of the books that had a great influence on other books that were written after it.
Yes. Now, the other person that Garrett would go on about was Tennessee Williams.
Yes.
And did Garrett, I can't remember if Garrett met Tennessee. It sounded like he did, but did you ever see Tennessee with Garrett?
No, not with Garrett. I met Tennessee once when I was with Marion Moore in Washington Square. He was a housemate of my friend Loker Raley. Loker lived on the ground floor of an apartment on Morton Street, and Tennessee lived on the third floor. And they knew each other, or were not bosom friends or anything, but they knew each other quite well. And Loker always slept later than Tennessee, and he would tell me how Tennessee would come down the stairs, and as he passed Loker's door, he would shout, "Ave," and Loker would sing back, "Atque," and Tennessee would reply, "Vale," and sail out the front door. And apparently this was a routine of theirs from time to time.
Yeah, I think you mentioned that story at the end of The Assassination of America.
Oh, do I? I didn't remember.
Yeah, explain.
Well, it's so long that I can't remember everything that I put in it. You know.
Right, what is the cultural references to that? Is some musical or some opera?
What is that?
Those words refer to an opera, don't they?
I mean, I agree. No, that's Hail and Farewell was what the gladiators said to the Caesars, whichever Caesar it was at the time, as they entered the Circus Maximus for combat with either each other or lions and buffalo or what it happened to be, and they would come before the placement of Chris Caesar was placed at the side of the Colosseum, and they would simply raise their swords as the Ave Atque Vale, in effect it was hail and farewell. Most of them didn't survive.
Wow.
Now that goes all the way back to 2,000 years.
Yes. So I recall Garrett talking about a poet named Mark somebody. I don't remember the last name, but he went on about how he won some award, a Poetry Village Award. And a Village Poetry Award? For the village somebody.
Yeah, I don't know. I was either responsible for a lot of those awards or knew everybody that entered them, but I have no idea who that might have been.
There wasn't an award named after Mark somebody. That doesn't sound familiar, right?
Mark Van Doren?
No, I know him. It wasn't his name. So the point is, if there was no Mark that an award was named after, then the person Garrett's talking about was named Mark, and he got an award. But
no,
that doesn't strike a bell.
No, I didn't. You must remember that in the village at one time, everybody who wasn't a painter or a composer or a general author was a poet. no matter what they wrote, they were a poet.
Yes.
Although, in point of fact, there were very few serious poets in the village. There were a great many poetasters, rhymesters, people who had never studied diversification or even read the important poets. So, one might come up with a dozen or two dozen names of people who called themselves poets in the village, and I might not have heard of any of them. But if it were any of the serious ones, then I would know them almost immediately. I mean, Millay lived down there, and Locher did down there, and Raymond Holden lived down there. And, I won't bore you with the names of people who no longer remembered, but there were a number of authentic poets that lived in the village one time, at least a dozen or two. And yet there were hundreds that called themselves poets.
Yes. Now, did you ever meet Allen Ginsberg?
He attended I mentioned earlier on that I had I created these programs called the Symposium for Cafes.
Yes.
And he attended one of them. So a friend of mine told me that he had brought him to one of them. But in terms of face-to-face, no. I know that I declined to meet Kerouac after he'd had his book published. But I'm trying to remember. There was one. He was but maybe the third best known of them, and I can't remember his name.
Gregory Corso?
Pardon me?
Gregory Corso,
yes. He used to hang out at the Pony Stables on 3rd Street, and I sat there of an afternoon at least three or four times talking to him. And the thing always struck me most about his career was that he told me on a couple of occasions that he had to get a poem finished that afternoon and get it off in the mail, because every time he sent his mother a poem, she sent him back $10. And so I believed him, and I think it was probably true.
Right. Okay, so did you ever see Garrett perform in theater?
Did I ever see him perform?
Yes.
No.
Broadway.
No. As I said, the only time I ever saw him perform was the time that he read a couple of poems for the symposium. But no, I never saw him in. Of course, that may have been before I knew him. I don't know if he was still doing any type of acting by the time we became acquainted.
Yeah. When you meet him, he's about 40. 6 years old, it would be, if it's 53.
Yeah, I would think so, at least, yeah.
Yeah. Now, I know that he was offered a role or participation in Eva LaGallien's repertory, and that's in the early 30s.
Oh, yes, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I know that he got to New York by the time he was 20, because I saw a photo of him as a model about
mm-hmm.
1927.
Yes.
So, yes, he might have been in theater in the 30s and 40s. Well, he was. I know he was.
That would be before we'd ever... Well, that'd be almost before I ever got to New York.
Yes, but he was opinionated about theater. He would talk about it with you, I guess, a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he also said, speaking of Kerouac, he once said to me that the character Dean Moriarty was based on him.
No.
We know it was based on Neil Cassidy, supposedly.
Yeah.
Maybe he didn't say it like that. I think maybe he said it like this. He said, very interesting that that book, such an important book, the main character has the name Dean in it. So he he liked the Dean aspect.
Yeah, no, that I can tell you as a point of fact that it's not was not the case.
No, yeah, I may be wrong to say he felt it was based on him, but he thought the name Dean was significant. That name was chosen. I don't know. Yeah, Kerouac would have been around in the village, right? He spent a lot of time in New York City in the
40s. For a while, but it was a very short period of time. He was mostly a West Coast figure, as was Ginsberg. I remember, just bring things to mind that I haven't thought about in scores of years, that one night I had been asked to recite some material at the Poetry Society of America, and to which I belonged for quite a while, and I read a few poems, and then whoever was moderating that day said, "Oh, have you met Louis yet?" And I said, "I've seen him around, but I haven't really met him." And he introduced this man, Louis Ginsberg. And it wasn't until at least a year later that I realized that Allen Ginsberg, the beat poet, was the son of Louis Ginsberg, who was very formal and denied the whole beat movement completely for several years, and then finally he got absorbed in it too. So I mean, I don't mean he participated, but I mean he. It became accepting of it, and I was in an antithetical faction to the entire beat movement. In the first place, I didn't regard most of it as poetry, and I regard Howl for the most part a lot of junk. The first 40 lines are not bad. The first 20 lines are quite good, but so much of the rest of it is just babbling, and I still don't. That is why I am now a totally obsolete character. I believe that poetry should be based upon versification, music, and be have a positive appeal, even if it's depressing. And I read the Harper's and the Atlantic Monthly and. New Yorker, and 90% of what they publish is simply not poetry. It's by any stretch of the imagination. So, as I say, fortunately am coming to the end of my tether, and I'm sure that I wouldn't have enjoyed living much into an era where painting is deteriorated, and music is deteriorated, and poetry is being obliterated.
Yes. It's interesting you say that, because I felt through the years, I mean, I had met Ginsberg, I knew a lot of the beatnik people, but when I encountered Garrett through the years, I got the feeling that he represented another stream of poetry, and that's what I wondered if you were, and you've just confirmed it.
Oh, well, I would have put it, and I think he would have put it, that we belong to the evolution of the history of poetry. We have absolutely nothing to do with this I was going to say form, but this formlessness that has assumed the name of poetry. It's simply, John Cage, the composer, once was giving a lecture, I mean a performance, and in Carnegie Hall, and for his he did his first couple of pieces, and then he went off stage, and then he came back to do in the next piece, and he sat down at the piano, and one could count something like from 1 to 60 as he sat there with his hands folded in his lap, and then he got off and got up and walked off stage, and there was considerable applause. That has been was his etude in silence.
Yes. And you,
so, you know, I just consider all that just ridiculous and absurd. So,
I don't
bother myself with it.
Right. So you were there when he performed that at Carnegie Hall or wherever it was?
No, a friend of mine was. A friend of mine who was trying to be au courant with what was happening, you know, in the music field. And so he decided to go hear a John Cage concert, and that was the third or fourth piece on the program.
And he reported that back to you?
Oh, yes. Yeah. It was in the newspaper. Yeah.
Right. So the
I think Vernon Rice or somebody like that covered it.
So, you know, I've studied with McLuhan for a long time, and he would say that new technologies, new forms of communication like television or the computer change the arts. Would you agree that the appeal of Ginsberg and Cage and that was due to rock and roll coming in and the whole electronic leisure society arts?
Well, they came in before rock and roll really became a major thing with Bill Haley and the Comets, and then here with Elvis Presley.
Well, the Beatniks identified with jazz.
Pardon me?
The Beatniks identified with jazz and bebop.
Well, now bop was entirely different. That was a highly sophisticated, inventive, new form of expression that was very musical. I remember the first bop records that ever came out on Musicraft with Dizzy Gillespie, Bird, Kenny Clarke, and I forgot who the other one was. I thought it was extremely exciting. And it evolved and evolved and evolved, and then it split off into cool jazz, which was essentially created by, or at least spun off of, the work of Lenny Tristano, the pianist. And that all was, the whole period of the 50s was exciting and fascinating. But then it, as the end of the 50s came in, it began to be evident that the people were playing, A was playing what B had played last year, and B was playing what A had played this year, and it was all becoming very repetitious. And in 1959, Miles Davis, maybe the last of the genuine great pop trumpeters, was asked, Bob has gone so far, where does it go from here? And he said, nowhere, jazz is dead. Mm. And from that point on, he never played in the way he had before. He went into Cuban motifs and so on and so forth, and all of which has nothing to do with jazz. But my conviction is that when you art leaves form behind, as a matter of fact, it was Frank Lloyd Wright who said art is form. When you leave form behind, then you leave art behind. And if you want to have something else that interests people, stimulates them in their own way, that's fine. But don't use the misnomer art, because that's not what it is.
That's right. So you didn't like the change in jazz signified by John Coltrane or Cecil Taylor?
Well, Coltrane at the first was fairly good, but then he simply went off into dissonance it couldn't even be called dissonance. They were discords. I was actually speaking of people who came after him, but in each of these instances, you can probably find somebody, some side that they did that was fairly effective. But in general, just taking the entire genre from 1960 or 1965 on, I have a friend down in Texas who's constantly sending me CDs. What do you think of this? What do you think of that?
Yeah.
And the only time I'm happy is when he sends me opera, which he really likes. But once in a while he sends me somebody, and he says, now this is interesting, don't you think so? He's a number of years younger than I am. And I'll write back, yes, it is interesting. And it was interesting when Al Haig played it in 1955. You know, these people simply listen, and they go back, and they steal like mad. And technically, sometimes they're better. You know, there's some of the old being this me, Duck Lewis, and people like that, were really not very good pianistically, technically, but their ideas were very interesting and exciting. And now the days, generally most of the pianists you hear are fairly good technicians, but they simply have nothing to say. It's exemplified by the fact that practically all of the singers today write their own material, and that's why all the material is terrible. It's you know, they use the same rhyme three times in a verse or something like that, and of course all of the vocal forms are distortions. I haven't heard a singer in 15 years that I wanted to listen to. There's nothing musical. There's nothing pretty. There's nothing attractive. There's nothing intellectually interesting. You know, you can go pretty far out with somebody like Sarah Vaughan and Billy Eckstein, people who used all sorts of plaited fifths and what have you, and they were really effective. People who just make a great deal of noise. As a matter of fact, I went to an art gallery last night to see a show, and where my wife had won a couple of prizes, and they had a band playing. The band was so noisy you couldn't tell what instruments were playing.
Yeah.
It was simply a huge conglomeration of noise.
Yeah.
So, as you can see, I belong to a historic past that doesn't believe that anything much is good today.
Right. Did you attend or talk about opera with Garrett?
No, I used to go to opera a good deal, but no, we never went together, and I'm not even sure that I was conscious of him being much of an aficionado of opera. Did he like opera?
Oh, yeah. If it was a long evening, he would eventually put on some opera records in Halifax.
No, we may have listened to music in his shop sometime, but I must admit I don't recall it.
Okay, when I think of you being with Garrett in his shop, did you find... Okay, you do say that he's one of the most unique people you ever met. Would you say that you were fascinated by him and his personality, or his range of learning, or both?
No, I was most...
or his friendliness.
I was most entertained by him as an individual, as personality, as a distinctive a character apart from most of the people. Always have to remember that when I reply to a question like this, that I lived for 25 years in the village, which was nothing but a huge assortment of unusual and remarkable and singular characters. So someone else who had spent their lives in Topeka, Kansas, or Manitoba, or someplace, run into Garrett, and he would be utterly distinctive and completely memorable. But he was just among a great many people I knew who were distinctive and unusual and attractive in their uniqueness. I don't know. Now, you can't remember things like this decades and decades later, but I don't recall having been preoccupied with his great learning or intellectuality. It was mostly his personality and his manner and his style. A lot of it was his style. I like style in people more than that he struck me as being enormously learned. That point was never made very strongly on me.
Right. Maybe it isn't learned I'm thinking of, because he didn't have much, you know, normal schooling. He didn't. I don't think he attended schools much as a youth. Maybe he did high school, but
mm-hmm.
he was basically.
Well, I rather had that impression. Yes.
Yeah. And basically, he was on the street after that, but he came from a secure, economically secure parentage, so mm-hmm. I think they helped him survive in New York. But he did have the talent of acting, and that would be maybe what he was an expert in the theater world.
Mm-hmm. I would think so.
Yeah, but yeah, he was, you probably couldn't say he was learned. He knew a lot about mm-hmm. a lot of different things, but he would actually make fun of learned people or imitate their pomposity more than
Well, I'm always wary of people who make fun of learned people.
And you don't remember him doing that?
No, no, yeah. Not particularly. On the other hand, you have to remember that of all the people I've known, and they have been legion, as a class, actors, theater people, have not been among the most perspicacious that I've ever known, or the most learned. The theater is one place where you can get by on talent without knowing very much of anything, if you've got the talent. Well, a classic example of that is that I knew Steve McQueen before he ever made it in Hat Full of Rain on Broadway, and he was a very common, vulgar guy. Nothing to recommend him at all.
A street
but
punk. Almost
he
a street
had personality,
punk.
Personality, and he had a sense of how to become somebody else. Namely, that's what acting is all about. It's abandoning yourself, especially when yourself is really inconsequential, and creating a persona of a different nature. And so he is a classic example of somebody who was absolutely non-entity when you met him on the street. He, as a matter of fact, I was having one of my symposiums one time, and we were doing a rehearsal on Saturday for a Sunday performance, and he came pounding on the door, and I said, "What do you want, Steve?" He said, "I want to come in." I said, "You're not in the show. Nobody comes in that's not in the program tomorrow." And he said, "Well, I want to come in. I'm a professional." And I said, "Professional what?" He hadn't done anything major that I'd heard of. And the last words that we ever exchanged on a personal level was, "You'll be sorry. I'm going to be famous, and you'll be sorry." And he went down the stairs. And of course, a couple of years later, he was in Hat Full of Rain on Broadway. And a couple of years later, he was out in Hollywood.
Right. So he was like a street punk.
Pardon me?
He was like a street punk.
Oh, yes, definitely, yeah. On the other hand, I knew Peter Breck. I don't know if that name's familiar to you, but he was in a thing called Big Valley on television for a number of years, and he made two or three movies. And he came to one of the symposium, and he just sat quietly and watched the show, and we went out and had drinks afterward and so on and so forth. And he had nothing to prove. Why? Because he was the son of the Breck hair lotion found fortune. He was worth millions.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
He didn't have to prove anything. So
that's right.
It's a matter of, upon what you base your personality.
Now, I think you your pen name is at some point was Toby Dean.
Yes.
Yeah, was that? Were you thinking of Garrett when you named yourself Dean?
Oh no, I hadn't thought about no. No, that's pure coincidence. I have no idea. I have written under three or four different pseudonyms at one time or another, and I think I just wanted a short, crisp name for business purposes and. But I have no idea it could have even gone back to childhood practically when there was a radio program that featured two private detectives, Dan Cassidy and Spencer Dean.
Mm.
And that might have been in the back of my mind. I have no idea, but I've thought of so many names over the last, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds, so I have no idea where it actually came from.
Right, so the extra coincidence is that the person who bought Garrett's house after several years after Garrett passed on,
mm-hmm.
I actually saw him and showed him some pictures of Garrett a couple weeks ago in Halifax. His name is Toby.
Oh, is it really?
Yeah. So, in a sense, he's Toby Dean. I mean, he took over Garrett Dean's home.
Yeah.
And there's more coincidence. So that resonates with your name. Now.
Yeah, of course. The one I use is not Toby. It's not T-O-B-Y.
Oh, what is it?
You know, they just made me, talking about it, you made me forget. It begins with T, Troy, T-R-O-Y.
Oh, it's Troy Dean, right. Sorry, yeah, I thought it was Toby Dean, I forgot. Yeah, Troy. Okay, so Garrett was, in terms of the village, just another unique individual, but I thought you got the impression that he was extra unique. And was he the unique person's unique person? Could you say that?
Well, as I said before, for one who was not surrounded most of one's life by a singular, extraordinary individuals, if one just as a was an office worker in in New York or something, he would have been very exceptional. The only reason, and he was exceptional. The only reason that he did not stand out more uniquely is because I knew so many exceptional people.
Yes.
You know, from Tennessee and Cummings and so on and so forth, but John Carradine and Steve McQueen. You know, there's so many of them that one does not stand out terribly more than the other.
Right.
Unless they happen to be one of the two or three geniuses I knew, but other than that, to be distinctive, you have to be distinctive apart from your surroundings. And if your surroundings are also distinctive, then you do not have the comparative evaluation.
Yes, but you did spend a lot of time, more time with Garrett than Tennessee Williams or E.E. Cummings, right?
Oh, yes. Yeah. No, I spent all in total over the years, probably an hour with Cummings and an hour with Auden and less than that with Tennessee. But I spent much more time with Steve than with the others.
You mean Garrett? With Garrett.
But these were not bosom pals or anything. These were just people one met.
Right, but you said Steve. You mean Garrett. You spent many more hours with
Garrett. Well, I mean, Garrett and I spent time together. See, that's an entire different thing. To know somebody is one thing, but to be friendly with somebody is something entirely different. You know, you're talking about much greater length of time and much more familiarity and... if you know somebody, you probably have some sort of personal exchanges, and you talk about things that are of consequence to you and what have you. But if one sits on the park bench with Auden, we talked about poetry.
Yeah.
And with Cummings, we talked about poetry and how much he hated the Roosevelts because he was absolutely detested them. Well, he was a great hater anyway. So, which is astonishing when you read the glorious verse that he wrote. But these were just acquaintances at best, whereas Garrett I regarded as a casual friend at one point. And of course, I mentioned my friend Loco Raley or Beto Nuno. Well, these were close personal friends. So that's the levels of, degrees that you ascend through the levels of familiarity.
Yes. So, yeah, Garrett's a casual friend, not a close friend.
No, because I would know more about him if he'd been a close friend.
Right.
But he didn't talk about his personal life. He didn't talk about brothers or sisters or fathers or mothers. We talked about ideas, not people.
That's right. And he maybe admired you from the distance. I mean, he admired your poetry.
Pardon me? Oh, well, I'm surprised that he didn't enough to mention it, but I know at the time he was socially complimentary, but I didn't think anything about it.
Right. You didn't think he'd be commenting on you 20 years later?
I certainly did not. I certainly did not.
Now, what year did you start being producer of the Long John Neville Show?
1959.
And was that the first overnight show or something?
It probably was. It was the first talk show of its kind. He created the talk show format. To begin with, he was the first one that had a panel. He didn't do it just alone. He had a guest, and always had three panelists, sometimes four. Excuse me. He he created the format. It always ran from 12 to 5, occasionally to 5:30, and it ran 6 days a week. And Sunday they did a rebroadcast of one of the earlier shows, not the one earlier of the week, but earlier of a couple of months before or something like that. And as I say, I was with him for over 6,000 shows. I produced over 6,000 shows for him.
How many years is that?
Was on myself for about 1,500 hours, something like that. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to say 6,000 shows. I meant 6,000 hours of shows.
How many years is that?
Oh, about four and a half.
Right. So there were not talk shows before that, and they didn't have people phoning in or anything?
Well, not that kind. Barry Gray was on WMCA at the Copacabana, the New York nightclub, and in the lounge, and he would interview starlets and passing celebrities for a few minutes. And his show lasted, I believe it was only an hour. There was Joe Franklin, and he had a show that lasted about an hour and a half, and he had people come in and sit down, very much the Johnny Carson format. The Merv Griffin format, you know, just somebody came in and sat down and talked to them for a while, and then they left and somebody else came in. But John was the only person that had ever put together an entire panel to discuss one subject for 5 hours with a premier guest. So it was a completely unique form of radio.
Yeah, did you take phone calls at that time?
Well, as a matter of fact, he did for a while, and then we got a couple of raving maniacs who, you know, were obscene as hell, and he just was able to cut them off in the middle of the second obscenity, and the management said no more phone calls. And John went to his second engineer. His first engineer was Jack Keane, who did the Metropolitan Opera broadcast, and the second engineer was a guy named Ralph Tinklepaw, who always loved his name. T-I-N-K-L-E-P-A-U-G-H. Well, sounds like a cat. And he did maintain all the equipment in it, besides being the relief engineer. And John asked him if he could work out anything where he could talk on the phone, but it wouldn't go out over the air for a little bit.
A delay.
And Tinklepaw said that yes, he thought he could, and 2 weeks later he asked John to come into the auxiliary control room, and he had set up a thing where the tape, of course all the shows were taped, where the tape went across the recording head, went around. Do you know what an Ampex tape recorder is like?
Yes.
Yeah, it's one of those big old monster things. You know?
Yeah.
Well, he had the tape, and it went off to the left, around to the corner. He put a spindle there, went down the side, put another spindle across to the back, another spindle down the right-hand side, another spindle, and back to the broadcast head. And it was a 7-second delay. And John could do whatever he wanted because he had a button, and he could stop the thing within tenth of a second, or a second, or 2 seconds, or 4 seconds, and it still wouldn't go out over the air. And he told Ralph to copyright this, or, you know, get a patent right away, and he didn't. And within about 3 weeks, NBC and CBS all had them. They all copied it, and he never got a penny.
Wow. But so he invented the delay.
He invented. Ralph Tinklepaw rendered the delayed broadcast tape. You know. Now, of course, they do it in a different, technically a different way. But his method was used for years and years and years.
Okay, so you're there. What time would you get to work, and what time would you get to bed if you had an all-night show like this?
Well, it was just somebody coming in. I went in the afternoon to book shows. I'd go in at about 2 until about 4, 5 o'clock, and I'd be on the phone and getting people, you know, all the book companies, all the publishers had publicity agents, and I'd be taking endless calls saying, do you want this one? Do you want that one? Here's a wonderful, great one for you, and et cetera. And then there would be just individuals who'd call up and want to be on. And we usually had about 20 or 25 calls a day, and we were going to have only one person on, of course. And so I would book maybe one or two or three shows ahead, and then I'd go home and I'd rest for a while, and I'd come back at about 11 or 11:30 and make sure everything was set up in the studio for John to go on. And John would come in at usually about 5 minutes to midnight and said that he never wanted to talk to the guests. He didn't, and he didn't talk to the panelists, all of them he knew very well, but until the coffee break, which was about 2:30. And he would just sit in his chair, and I would usher the guests in and tell him, you know, don't converse with John until he goes on the air. And it would start at midnight and go through to 2:30, and we'd take the time out for about 30, 40 minutes to eat food that was sent over from Carnegie Delicatessen, one of the famous delicatessens midtown in New York, and then we'd go back on the air and finish off the show.
So it was a live show?
Pardon me?
It was a live show.
Oh yes, yeah.
But you
always
were saying,
live, except for the Sunday show, which was a repeat.
But you're saying that the tape, the delay, that Ralph and Bennett was a tape, and the shows were being taped.
Oh, that was only for the telephone calls.
Oh, okay.
Oh, not the show. Oh, no, the show was all live. No, that was just for the telephone calls, because John maintained terrific control over, you know, all the people that were working the show. And nobody would say anything that was untoward, because the one thing you could be certain of, anybody who was on the show wanted to be on the show again. And all they had to do was say one thing that was, you know, off color or something, and they'd simply never be on the show again. So that was not a problem. No, it was the telephone calls that could be very raunchy. And the tape delay was completely for the telephone calls.
Right, and once Ralph had made the delay, then he started taking calls again.
Pardon me?
Once the delay had been invented, John started taking telephone calls again.
Oh, yes, yes. He took him for years after that, yeah.
Okay, so do you, you're aware of the book on his wife, Candy Jones. Do you believe that she was hypnotized by the CIA?
Well, John did an original book called The Way Out World. Well, his name was on it. I did that for him.
Yeah.
I wrote that for him. He came to me some years later with the idea of doing something with his new child bride, as he called her. She was 45 at the time, I think. And I asked what it was, and he gave me a general idea, and had said that he'd done these tapes and so on and so forth. And I said, thanks, but no thanks. I'd already had enough investigative experience regarding the assassination and so on and so forth, and I didn't want anything to do with the company anymore. So I declined, and he went on and had Don do it. And no, I've always thought it was mostly her imagination. I think she might have calmed him a little. And she might have done a little bit of stuff, I think it was enormously elaborated, and her importance was exaggerated, and so on and so forth. So I don't place much credence in the book in terms of its overall content.
Okay, now how much older was John if she was 45?
Oh, I guess John died in his 60s, so I guess he was probably 10 or 12 years older than she was, something like that.
Right.
Maybe not even that, because she'd been a model in the late 30s and early 40s, very famous model. And he had photographed her then and then hadn't seen her for 25 years or something. And I would, they may have been closer in age than I was originally thinking.
Okay.
I'd have to look it up. I just honestly don't remember. But I'm sure that he was no more than 10 years older than she was, maybe a little bit more.
Right. Now, back to Garrett. Do you remember, if you're, I'm assuming you're visiting his store through the 50s and even into the 60s?
You mean, did I visit the store during that period?
Yeah, into the 60s.
I was probably up there sometime in the early 60s, I imagine, you know.
Now, did he discuss the, say, a more negative view of New York? I mean, did he agree with you that it wasn't going the way he found comfortable for
him? My impression was that we agreed both the village was deteriorating and that the city in its, you know, in its entirety was not what it had been once. That it's hard to imagine that we wouldn't have had that opinion because it was so obvious that it was deteriorating.
Right. He used to sit, tell me that the Rockefellers ruined New York.
Well, from an architectural point of view, one can make that claim, although on the other hand, if you like modern architecture, perhaps you would think the other thing. But the Rockefellers probably did more to ruin the country than they did to ruin New York, because they put a lot of money into New York. But the Rockefeller Foundation and David Rockefeller in particular, who was most people don't realize, especially outside the United States, that David Rockefeller was a great power. He had three brothers who were governors of New York,
Arkansas,
Kansas, and wherever the other one.
And Arkansas,
right. And and Jay was a governor too. So, the three governors combined did not have the power that David did.
Right. Now,
you know, he was the head of the former, the formulator of the trilateral commission, and he was very involved in the Council on Foreign Relations, and was a member of the Bilderberg Group, and just, you know, wherever power was, that was where he was, and his power was enormous.
Right, and he founded the Bilderbergers with Prince Bernhard in 1954.
Well, Prince Bernhard really founded it, but with a half a dozen other people, and it eventually grew to be a fairly large group of perhaps as many as 40 people, but all of them, of course, multimillionaires and great powers around the world, and meeting in the same hotel and Belgium. But although one might claim that Bernhard was essentially a figurehead, but I think that's unlikely. He was extremely wealthy himself and had tremendous European connections. And the Bilderberg Group was essentially controlled European finances, whereas the Trilateral, of course, who was primarily concerned with the United States in relationship to Japan, and the Council on Foreign Relations on all of the United States connections around the world.
Yes. Did you ever run across the Turnin Taxis family?
Which family?
Prince Turnin Taxis, T-H-U-R-N-U-N-D.
Oh, no. No. No, I didn't move in those circles. my life is just based upon connections and research, and the fact that nobody expects a poet to be particularly interested in behind-the-scenes activities of international affairs.
Yes.
One can move about a little more easily than one might if one was a journalist.
Yes, yes. No, it's just the Turnin Taxis have been very powerful for over 500 years, and I was just wondering if Prince Bernhard would have represented that kind of wealth.
Well, he represented a great deal.
Yeah.
As you Supply. His family goes back a long, long way. And it's like various other things that are totally unknown in this country, that the naval intelligence is the most powerful intelligence group in the United States of the military groups, and its connection with British intelligence, naval intelligence, goes back to before the Revolutionary War. And I mean, all this sort of stuff that you try to tell somebody about these things, and they think it's mythology, but in point of fact it isn't. It's just the way things have always been.
Yes. Now, do you think David Rockefeller had some role in the President JFK assassination?
Was it the Kennedy?
Yeah, the first Kennedy assassination.
No, I think unlikely. He simply wouldn't. His power is so great, he simply wouldn't find it necessary. People with somewhat lesser power would find it necessary to eliminate the head of state. But ultimately, when you're talking about that level of international influence, it is so great that one, a president or being there or not, let me put it this way, it makes absolutely no difference who's president. It's not going to change anything. It may change whether you go to war or whether you don't, but war is an ongoing action of industry. That's where the millions are made, by going to war, not oil exploration or anything, by going to war.
Yes.
That's why we're almost always at war with somebody.
Yes. So do you see J. Edgar Hoover as a cause of the JFK assassination?
Oh, tool. He is important only to the people that he had files on, but he was not an independent power himself. No, he just like the head of the CIA or the head of the DIA or the Federal Bureau, they're all simply instruments in the overall pattern of control in the Western world, particularly in this country.
Sure.
It's one of the reasons why about 80% of all the wealth is owned in this country by about 1.5% of the population.
Yes, so you don't see Hoover as initiating the assassination?
No, I think covering up, but
yes.
Not. I think it's he hated the Kennedys. There's no question about that. But he also was an individual who maintained his power, such as it was, for several decades by never sticking his neck out. For instance, he denied for years and years and years that there was any mafia, that
yes.
There was any syndicate, that there was any coordinated crime body. And the general feeling is that they had enough on him to destroy him if he pushed too far. They expected him to push, but did, you know, up to a point to make himself look good. But after that, no, nothing would have been tolerated, and he would have been demolished. So he just wasn't as important as people think he was.
Right. So do you then think the mafia was the main initiator of it?
I think it unlikely. I think they're much more likely that elements were instrumental in the mechanics, but not in the creation. Bobby was a threat, but not enough of a threat. And besides which, it requires some very sophisticated thinking to assume that as Sam, I believe it's Giancana, was supposed to have said, we can't go after the body until we cut off the head.
Yes.
And so actually, if that's a pretty erudite way of looking at an assassination. But I think that certainly some of the instrumentality may have come via the syndicate, but it's not necessary. There are professional assassins all over the world, and they're available. And generally speaking, of course, if you hire an assassin to do the job, you hire an assassin to kill the assassin after the job is done.
That's right. So would you then tend to think along Mae Brussels' lines that it was the CIA and the Project Paperclip Nazi scientists who
I find Mae Brussels' theories somewhat, let's say, incompatible with my own and with logic in general. I think she tended to see conspiracy everywhere. And one of the problems with conspiracy is that if you see it everywhere, then you don't see it where it specifically is.
Yes.
It blurs in the plethora of conspiracies. I think we're long past the point where we'll ever have any real idea exactly how the thing was planned and how it was executed. But my tendency is to believe that probably everybody who was instrumental in creating the series of events that led to his death have long since been dead themselves, and that most of the operators, that is, the mechanics who actually did the work, have long since been dead themselves. I think most of those were probably dead within a week. And of November 22nd.
Yes.
So there's all one's going to find are little bits and pieces of mostly probably relating to someone who knew something was afoot, something was perhaps in the wind. They heard this, they heard that, the third thing. But as far as the solution, it'll never be more solved than was the shooting of Lincoln, which is. To this day, of course, the question is, was Stanton actually involved or was he not? And it's the nature of assassinations throughout history. You know, did one of these czar's children survive or did she not? There's always the question. All my life I've been intrigued by the idea that, no, Jesse James was not actually shot, it was somebody else. it's an irresistible temptation to think that heroes or people of great stature, whatever happens to them is some sort of complicated and dramatic Richard II type thing, but in point of fact, most often it's fairly simple, and if it's a really professional job, everybody who does it is eliminated before they get a chance to turn around, and the people who plan it, sometimes they're eliminated too, but most often they just never say anything again.
Right, so you would tend to think that it was on the level of some intelligence agency.
I think it's very difficult to imagine that it could have been done without the
naval intelligence.
Certain elements of the, not the entire agency, any entire agency. No intelligence agency is a integrated conglomerate whole. It has, it's compartmentalized. It has the assassin group and the mechanical group and the publicity group and the promotion group, and et cetera. But certainly I think that at least two of the intelligence agencies probably knew it was going to happen if they were not actually involved in some of the mechanics. And I think the somebody in the syndicate was probably aware it was going to happen and may have been provided a shooter. I think most likely the shooters were international professionals, and they were eliminated shortly after. They may have never even gotten out of the country. So all of these points are simply deductive. After going through my, I figure about 10 or 15,000 pages of stuff I had to do the book. These are simply conclusions I come to because they are logical ones and reasonable ones, and they supply an answer to why this, that, or the third thing happened. But there are no facts left to collect that are ever going to clarify exactly what happened on November 22nd, 1963.
Right, but in terms of intelligence, you're implying that the naval intelligence would be one of the
best. Well, I don't think it was involved in this. The naval intelligence is just the most powerful group, intellectually powerful group in the intelligence community in this country for a great many years. And it is one that has always been international in its scope, whereas Army intelligence, for example, is fairly limited. The CIA allegedly doesn't work in the United States. Of course, it does all the time, but
yeah.
It's supposed not to. And but naval intelligence goes back, and its connections go back into British intelligence, especially naval. British naval intelligence by hundreds of years. So these things are enormously complicated, and it's very hard to put them into any simple terms, because they're simply not simple.
Right, and you're particularly saying that you don't think the naval intelligence was involved with President Kennedy assassination.
No, I don't think so at all. Oddly enough, if for no other reason than he was a former naval officer.
Right.
That might have they might have done it to an Army officer, but not a naval officer.
Okay. Are you aware of the author James Ellroy?
Pardon me?
Are you aware of the author James Ellroy?
I don't think I really hear clearly what you're saying.
Oh, okay. Are you aware of the author James Ellroy?